Good evening. My name is Alana Lindgren, and I am the chair of the Department of Theater. And on behalf of my colleagues and our students, I would like to welcome you to this evening's performance of Mamahood, Bursting into Light, created and performed by Nicole Natris, one of our wonderful alumna. It's a fantastic show. It was, as a person without children, it was a huge education for me when I saw it. So tell me what you think afterwards. It was a bit traumatic, but very, very funny. I'm also very pleased to ask you this evening to be mindful every time that we gather here at the Phoenix of the Lekwungen-speaking peoples on whose traditional territory the University of Victoria stands, and the Esquimalt, Songhees, and Wasanich peoples whose historical relationship with the land continues to this day. It is a very great personal treat for me to introduce our speaker this evening, Dr. Sheila Rabillard, who has been a very important friend and mentor for me. She is an associate professor in the Department of English. She studies modern and contemporary drama and performance with a special interest in gender critique, Indigenous performance, and environmental theater. She has published on Canadian, US, and British dramatists, including Carol Churchill, Sam Shepard, Michel Tremblay, and our own in BC, Marie Clements, a Métis writer here in BC. Her current research interests are, Dr. Rabillard's current research interests, not Marie Clements. she teaches English. We have to get the pronouns all correct. Her current research interests are staging motherhood and performances of new maternalisms. Please welcome Dr. Sheila Rabillard.
Thank you, Alana, and thank you for not mentioning that I taught you, because that's a real tell, a real giveaway. I too enjoyed seeing this play, and my job tonight is to create a context of a sort that will help you to really enjoy it as well. Now, one of my contextual bits of information is that I too was an older mother, and had the great delight. I was quite a bit older, I think, when I gave birth than Nicole Natras. So I had the pleasure of having nurses come into my room after I bore the child to ask me exactly how old was I and how did I do that. And eventually I got really cross and threw them out, at which point my wonderful family doctor said that I was channeling those maternal hormones, and I was protecting the offspring, and that was natural to throw people out. Okay, so let's get serious. Speaking of serious, there's a wonderful statement in a recent review in the London Review of Books, review of Sheila Hetty's book called Motherhood, and that's a really provocatively named book because it's all about Sheila Hetty not being a mother. At any rate, the reviewer says, "I was reminded of Camus' myth of Sisyphus. To decide whether or not life is worth living is to answer the fundamental question in philosophy. Camus meant that the only serious philosophical problem was that of suicide. It seems to me that the most serious philosophical problem could equally be that of parenthood, to decide whether or not life is worth bringing into existence." So, just watch what Nicole Natras does, and you'll see her enjoyment of life in everything she does. You'll be quite convinced, I think, that she made the right decision. So my title is tentatively What to Expect When You're Expecting. I read a lot of those books. And What to Expect When You're Expecting Mamahood, Bursting into Light. So first off, I should introduce Nicole Natras. She is, as Alana Lindgren said, a Phoenix alumna. She's a writer, she's an actor, she's a Camosun College instructor, she is a mother, and she's probably many more things that I don't even know about. She has performed across Canada in regional theaters, as well as in commercials, radio, film, TV. Her first solo show, which she wrote and performed, called Brownie Points, Boldly Going Where No Brownie Has Gone Before, received 2 Jesse Richardson Theater Award nominations for original performance and for outstanding new play. Tonight's play, Mamahood, has received professional productions with Solo Festival in Toronto, Vancouver Island University Theatre in Nanaimo, Fire Hall Theatre in Vancouver, Sunset Theatre in Wells, and Theatre One in Nanaimo. Okay, so as I was thinking about the talk, I decided that Mamahood referred to a hood, as in neighborhood, you know, here in the hood of Mamahood. It was territory to explore, and it was territory that hasn't been explored as much as you would think in theater. So what is her territory? Her territory is pregnancy, birthing, and afterbirthing, that is, a mother's myriad experiences and actions in her baby's infancy and early toddlerhood. So if we take that as what the hood is, in that neighborhood, there are really surprisingly few plays to compare. So this is my first problem in trying to set a context for you. What other plays would be like this, comparable? I'm sort of doing the Amazon algorithm, like if you liked dot, 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 then you will like dot, dot, dot. So what would I put here? Now, in contrast to thinking about the absence of plays about this particular neck of the woods, there are quite a few explorations of this territory in other literary forms right now. For instance, memoirs of mothering experiences in print and in online mummy blogs, novels, a spate of recent novels, a great one called Sight that came out in 2018 by Jesse Greengrass, a scary one just translated in 2018, written in French in 2016, The Perfect Nanny, about what happens, you know this, okay. No spoiler alerts, but boy oh boy, is that a scary novel to read, if you're a parent, even if you're not. And then Sheila Hetty's somewhat auto-fictional novel about choosing not to be a mother. And that's not forgetting the philosophical, political, book-length reflection by cultural critic Jacqueline Rose called Mothers, an Essay on Love and Cruelty, which it is. It's very interesting. So why hasn't there been more theatrical exploration of this hood of pregnancy, birth, and the period of intensive nurturing? It's got a lot of the ingredients that should make for good drama, right? Given contraception and reproductive technology, there are many more moments of choice rather than why did I do that, you know, when I had that 12th glass of wine, which used to be the only moment of choice, maybe glass 11 and no children would have resulted. So there's lots more choice, moments of internal debate, many more opportunities for suspense, given the unknowns of medicine and biology, plenty of opportunities for the operations of circumstance and fate, many occasions for supporting characters to step up or to disappoint, and for a protagonist to venture into a new world. So I think it should make really good drama. But as I say, surprisingly, in this particular area of pregnancy, birthing experience process, nurturing the very young infant when it's so totally dependent, there are only two plays that really come to mind as being directly comparable, as capable of setting a context for what Nicole Natras has done. One of them is from quite close to home, and that's Mum's the Word. And like you, probably you've seen one or two or maybe three of those Mum's the Word productions. The first one came out in 2000, and that's the one that deals with the earliest maternal experience, so it's the most directly comparable with the territory that Nicole Natras is looking at. And it's written, that was written and conceived and written and performed by Carson, Dom, Kelly, Nicole, Pollard, and Williams, and published in 2000. So it focuses, that first Mum's the Word, on much the same period of mothering as Mamahood. Like Mamahood, it's based in the personal experiences of women writers who are also women creative artists and performers. And if you appreciate the comedy of Mum's the Word, you'll definitely enjoy Natras's ability to see the funny side of mishaps and her skilled physical comedy. Just wait till you see her and her cat managing together to conduct a pregnancy test. And remember, it's a solo performance, so she's both. She's her and the cat. However, Mum's the Word is a collective enterprise, very much collective, in the writing, in the performance. Its tone is comic throughout, which is not precisely the case with Mamahood. And it's also structured like a review, a series of dynamic numbers, musical numbers even, presenting a variety of comic representative maternal experiences. So Mamahood has some music. It's also very funny. But it has an intensity of focus that's derived from its single protagonist performer author. She combines all these things together. Natress takes us on a journey, not just chronologically organized from pre-birth to post-birth, but through an interconnected sequence of emotions as her particular and personal story of Mamahood unfolds. She shares with us an adventure, an arc of action, and a process that has changed her. And now, looking farther afield for the other direct point of comparison I could find, this is farther afield because it comes from the U.S. and from a little bit longer, it comes from the U.S., let's say. It's a play that warrants comparison. It's Birth by Karen Brody, and it was first performed in 2006 and published in 2008. Now, I am a bit tentative about comparing this play because it's quite different in some respects. This is a play by a one-time birth activist who now is a self-described rest activist. And I can see how the arc of Nicole Natras's play might well lead you from birth to rest. She really makes us feel what it's like to work hard as a mother. Birth by Brody presents the birthing experiences of eight different women with eight different kinds of birthing plans that are equally likely or unlikely to match the actual birthing events acted out on stage with vigorous vocal effects. Like Mamahood, this theater piece gives full play to the potential for drama in the birthing process itself. Unlike Mamahood, however, birth focuses on the delivery process almost exclusively. Whereas in Mamahood, while birthing is central, the fraught and sometimes frantic processes of expectant motherhood and infant care are certainly given their due. And birth focuses on the delivery room largely in response to its U.S. origins and context. So that's both good and ill. It makes Nicole Natras's creation genuinely Canadian when you compare it to what's going on in Brody's play. So by saying it focuses and it's responsive to its U.S. origins, I really mean that what it shows is in eight individual, middle-class, quite well-off women struggling with a system that's really intransigent because of a number of socioeconomic factors which come into play in the U.S. and don't come into play in quite the same way in Canada. So the women struggle to control their birthing process within a relatively privileged context, and yet one that doesn't protect them from institutional and professional structures that are hierarchical, conservative, technocratic, and hemmed in by deep fear of malpractice suits. In Mamahood, in contrast, you'll find a strong-voiced, strong-souled doula, voiced by Nicole Natras, who is an ally of the mama and who seems to operate quite well in all settings with no institutional opposition. Brody's birth is based on actual experiences, and in its factual inspiration, then it resembles Mamahood. However, unlike Mamahood, with its vivid single protagonist and strong arc of emotional development, Brody's play offers a variety of contrasting experiences by characters that are very lightly sketched in terms of psychological depth. In fact, the birthing stories of the eight characters are derived from the many tales that Brody heard as she taught birthing classes. She's condensed them into typical tales, making her drama a little bit like verbatim theater, except minus verbatim theater's emphasis on using only the actual words of interviewees. And now I have to tell you that one of those experiences, I will never be able to tell which amongst those eight, may be my colleague, Professor Helga Thorsen's birth story, because Helga Thorsen, who's a professor in the German department, was actually a client of Karen Brody when Karen Brody was teaching birthing classes. So, further difference, Brody's birth is designed for amateur performance, and for a while it was performed across the U.S. and in some other areas as well, in Canada and Europe, on Labor Day. It made best sense in the North American context. Yep, I saw it in Seattle, and it was quite an inspiring experience. It was intended always to be followed by a talkback involving birthing experts of various types who answer questions and facilitate audience discussion. And because it was devised to promote the cause of better birthing practices, it has been called the Vagina Monologues of Childbirth. Now, Mamahood, I understand, likewise, has offered, and each night here and tonight as well, will continue to offer an opportunity after the performance for discussion with experts in various aspects of mothering who are glad to share their knowledge. Yeah. But Mamahood is distinctly not amateur. It's highly professional, both in its writing and its performance. And I wouldn't compare Mamahood to the Vagina Monologues, although you have to be prepared for strong language and the mention of body fluids and private bits. So maybe the best comparison that prepares for the pleasures of this performance is Joan McLeod's Gracie, which I had the pleasure of seeing last year at the Belfry. And it doesn't touch on maternity at all, in a way. But Gracie is a one-woman performance on a relatively empty stage that makes you see and hear a whole community. And so does Mamahood. Mamahood makes you see and hear friends, husband, doula, hospital staff, medical specialists and technicians, including an anesthesiologist. You'll have to wait to encounter that anesthesiologist, a social worker, and even the cat, as I mentioned, who is vividly present on stage. And as in McLeod's territory, which McLeod's play was about a girl growing up in a very fundamentalist sect, so it was unknown territory for much of the audience. So here, too, we're entering unknown territory, because as my mother very helpfully told me when I was pregnant and asking her advice, sweetheart, every pregnancy is different, and you never know what to expect. So, with Nicole Natras, we enter that territory of the unexpected, and we cheer for her all the way. So that's the relevant and comparable kinds of context I could think of. And against that, I'd like to put the context of plays that are in some ways irrelevant to this because they neglect this territory quite sadly. And that's the tradition of theater from the classics to the present. At least theater as written by men has very, very rarely dealt with anything remotely to do with pregnancy, birth, and infant nurturing. Now, there's plenty about mothers, but not much of it is very complimentary. So I had wanted to call this Motherhood Out and Loud, this talk, because I thought, for the most part, pregnancy, birth, and nurturing infants used to be the sort of thing that had to be said not out loud, but quietly, and not in public, just between women at the kitchen table. And it certainly was not on stage. You could even say that it qualified as, you know, originally obscene meant not on stage. So originally this was a kind of unmentionable sort of thing. So think about the women, the mothers, who do make it into the classics. There's Medea. Okay, not a good example, right? She kills her children. And there, of course, there are up-to-date versions of Medea. There's Strindberg's The Father, in which the mother does not literally kill her children, but freaks out her husband and drives him literally mad by telling him the child may not be his, and how is he going to tell? This is prior to DNA testing. So that's the destructive, anti-patriarchal mother who's going to mess up the line of inheritance. There's the mother as mourner, eternal mourner of the dead, classically Euripides' Trojan women, where the women all mourn the destruction of the city and of their civilization. Not so classically, recently, 20th century sings Mora in Riders to the Sea, who laments for all her sons and in a way for all the audience, mortal as we are. Not too cheery, and definitely not Mamahood territory. And then, somewhat more sympathetically, there's Motherhood as subjection. That is, even though written by men, you can see plays like the plays of Ibsen as noticing that motherhood may be burdensome, inconvenient, part of what keeps you locked in place, even in an unsatisfactory marriage. Think of Nora, who famously walks out on her children, and say in the recently performed Doll's House Part 2, gets to be confronted by her abandoned child, at least one of the children, and called to account, in a way, by husband and child. So what could hold you in place, or what you, a burden that you take up, perhaps reluctantly, or reject? There's Ibsen's Hedda as well. If you recall, the play opens with her coming back from a very long honeymoon trip, and her husband points out that she's become suddenly plump and delightful. Why has she become so plump? Well, first off, this is unmentionable, right? So the audience has to catch why she's become so plump, with a big hint when the auntie, the doting aunt who's raised her husband Tesman, comes over and kisses her on the forehead, you know, sort of blessing her as vessel of the next generation in the patriarchy. But Tesman is not the husband that Hedda would have wanted, so she retreats from the topic of conversation and from the husband at the same time. You can see there Ibsen's a bit sympathetic to Hedda, but then on the other hand, Hedda causes a suicide and shoots herself, so she too is not the ideal mother figure that I'd like to think about. Well, there are Freudian smother mothers, stage mothers like Gypsy. There's a lovely play from the 1930s called The Silver Cord, in which a mother tries to keep her grown son tied to him with a silver umbilical cord, you know, wrapped around his neck, so to speak, by welcoming her honeymooning son and bride home and setting them up in bedrooms so that the husband's bedroom communicates with the wife, not the wife's, no, the mother's, and the wife is somewhere down the hall. It goes from bad to worse. There's Amanda in Glass Menagerie trying to marry her daughter off. Oh, dear. And then with the 20th century, male playwrights begin to confront more directly that maternity is a frightening power. So in Pinter's The Homecoming, it's a struggle to capture a woman who's been brought on stage and introduced into an all-male household and bring her into the center of the household where she can replace the dead mother and also service the widowed father and everybody else there too. It is truly a scary picture of female sexuality and power. And to make things worse, the fading patriarch who is trying to draw her in and who praises and denigrates his dead wife in a display of stereotyping power also claims that he's suffered the pains of childbirth and its after effects. Well, I've just about run out of time. I can tell you that women playwrights have explored rather different territory. They've looked at some of these same ideas, that is, that maternity is a great power, that it has a place within patriarchy and maybe an impetus to break out of patriarchy, and has explored these things from a rather different perspective. So I just recommend for your future reading a wonderful play by Lisa Krohn called Well, that deals with a daughter's loving breakaway from her mother. Machinal from 1928, which includes a childbirth scene, a horrific childbirth scene. She was early on the spot, noting that medicalized birth is also a controlling birth. Sylvia Plath, who you probably know as poet, but also wrote a suite of poems called Three Women, A Poem for Three Voices, which was broadcast on the BBC in 1962, as a kind of, almost like a Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood, that is, you get three voices, but voiced by the same speaker, and the three women are all women in a maternity hospital who have quite different attitudes towards maternity. And then coming closer to the present, we have Tina Howe's Birth and Afterbirth, and I can't summarize that for you because it's just too bizarre. Marina Carr's Low in the Dark, which is Brechtian absurd, and a man and a woman compete to give birth to more offspring. And then on a less absurd and more political level, there are a number of women playwrights who have explored the fact that infants are infants and embryos are much more vulnerable to economic deprivation and environmental poisoning than grown-ups are. And so they've explored that aspect of maternity. I'm thinking of Carol Churchill's The Skryker and Marie Clement's Burning Vision, the latter in particular, because you get a wonderful sound overlay between a ticking Geiger counter, which is measuring, atomic pollution, yeah, and the beating of the heart of the infant in the womb, and these two things. Plus, it's a ticking of the clock. It's sort of like a time bomb. It's quite horrible. The Geiger counter sound, the heartbeat sound, the clock ticking sound, all sort of coinciding together, and in no exploitive way, making us pay attention to nurturing as a serious duty and bringing children into the world as a serious duty. And now, just as a final note, lest you think that I'm totally anti-male, I have to give credit to George Bernard Shaw, who wrote some powerful mothers into his plays, but also in something I found scooting around on the internet the other night, he engaged in a correspondence with a young man from the U.S. about birth control and motherhood. He expressed a decided support for birth control and showed strong sympathy for the pain and risk of childbirth. What did he write? He wrote, "If I were a woman, I should refuse to bear a child for less than $10,000. And a nation that will not guarantee the proper nurture of the children does not deserve to have them. Furthermore," he says, "the woman risks her life and gets torn to pieces, almost, in the birth process, and that is quite as much as she can be reasonably expected to undertake, even with a full guarantee that the subsistence of her child and of herself as his guardian shall be guaranteed, and that she shall not have it crying to her in vain for food whilst Pekingese dogs are eating cutlets in the next street." So he believed firmly that the community should be part of rearing the child. Notice he's quite aware of the pain of childbirth, and he was also not the father of any children. So he's using his imagination, as the play Mamahood invites us to use our imagination. He once said that the best kind of courtship was the courtship conducted by post. So he was married, but as I said, the marriage was childless. So as Shaw invites us to use our imagination, even if we are not bearing children and can never bear children, to use our imagination, to use our sympathies, to think about the experience, the planet, the motherhood territory that our play tonight is going to take us to. Now, it's customary after talks to have questions, and I don't know if I can answer any of them, but perhaps we can answer them collectively. So are there questions or topics that you think are worth discussing as we prepare to enjoy the play?
If you were conducting an affair by post, would the postscript be a child?
Good one, yes, absolutely.
I'd be interested if anyone's explored women choosing to have children only through artificial insemination or
that's a good question. Whether it's been, I'm sure it's been explored in things like memoirs.
Yeah.
And I know there was there was a sort of museum display of about 10 years ago at the Wellcome Institute in England, in London, which is, you know, it's associated with medical research, the Wellcome Institute, but they also put on displays to educate the public. It was called My Glass Body, and it was about all kinds of things having to do with things, with the way in which medical devices look into the pregnant body and the way in which that has changed, including, of course, the interactions that have to do with in vitro fertilization and so on. And then, of course, there's Carol Churchill, my favorite playwright, who wrote A Number, which is, it's not exact, it's about cloning, right? So in a sense, it's about the kind of extreme verge that you can imagine in a sort of sci-fi way about why you might seek to have a child. There's a play by Wharton Baker, too, and the name of it escapes me, in which one of the characters is adopting and another character is pursuing in vitro fertilization, and they sort of dialogue with one another. If the name of the play comes back to me, I'll let you know, but at the moment, I'm too packed with knowledge, right, to retrieve.
You did very well, yes. So packed.
So, questions? Yeah, that's another thing that would be very dramatic to explore, wouldn't it? Because there are all kinds of suspense, all kinds of choice. Can I spend money on another round of in vitro fertilization?
Family reactions.
Family reactions, exactly. Is a family going to say, hooray, or, oh my gosh, you're a lab rat, you're not a person?
What do you do with the leftovers?
Sorry?
Leftovers, too, the ones that don't get become children.
Right? Yeah. Apparently one of the things that's becoming more common is for young women to be encouraged to freeze their eggs. And so that opens up all kinds of other prospects and possibilities. Yes?
And sort of following to that is the idea now with the amount of DNA testing that people are discovering lies their parents told them, mm-hmm. whether it was lies about adoption mm-hmm. or relatives that... Exactly.
Yeah, well said. So you get one family story and one mother-child relationship, and then somewhere in your lifespan, the story has to change. That could... Boy, we've got lots of potential material. I hope there's some playwrights in the audience, too. I should mention that what... I gave scant attention to mothers and daughters, partly because it didn't fit with the birthing quite so well. But there's a number of really brilliant plays where daughters try to interact with their mothers and mothers with their daughters in more generous ways, such as that play Well that I mentioned by Lisa Crone. And it's about a woman whose mother seems to have some sort of chronic ailment that's not been properly diagnosed. So it gets into the territory of how people, especially bystanders, interpret medical choices. Like the daughter is not inside her mother's experience, so she always wonders whether it's entirely accurate that she suffers so much, or is it some kind of hypochondria, and yet she does suffer. And the daughter is diagnosed by the mother as having the same disease and is sent to get cured by having virtually everything that could possibly cause, you know, your immune system get stimulated and stripped away. So it's a really fascinating play, and it's played on a double level, so that the woman, Lisa Crone, who is in fact a monologue artist, comes out on stage and says, I'm going to conduct this monologue, really, about my past, and I've got a few characters, people on stage to act it out. And then her mother appears on stage and interrupts and talks back. And, of course, brings treats, right? Moms do that, right? So they say, she interrupts partly to say, I've got a case of potato chips that I bought on sale a couple of months ago, and I'm sure people here really want it. And she interrupts and starts dealing with the audience. And now I have to interrupt because we've just got the signal that we need to clear out of the theater so that the stage can be set properly for the performance tonight.
Before we go, though, please join me very much.